to that.
So this is work undertaken as part of my PhD at the University of Queensland with Tim Relph and Casey Myers. Actually, I'll be finishing my PhD the end of this year and looking for postdocs, so if anyone knows any openings, feel free to talk to me about that. If you want to throw some money into a closed time-like curve, as it were. Now, at the bottom of every research paper, there's always some underlying question which we're trying to get at. And in this case, I would say the question is, what happens when we modify quantum mechanics to allow for causality violation? Causality violation meaning that an event can affect events in its own causal past. So there's no definite causal ordering between two time-like separated events. You can't say which one came before which or which was the cause of which. And we should perhaps not be surprised that this will turn out to lead to nonlinear effects, because ultimately the outcome of some event is then going to depend on the event itself. This is a bit of a wishy-washy way of saying it, but I'll make this more precise. So you might say, well, why? Why on earth would we want to try and violate causality? We like causality. But there are perhaps reasons to consider doing this, both of which are ultimately connected to the problem of quantum gravity and how to unite quantum mechanics with general relativity. And it's interesting that causality enters into the usual formalism of quantum mechanics almost by fiat. It's just the way that we formulate quantum mechanics in terms of an assumed background space-time, such that we can foliate it into space-like hypersurfaces and define the quantum state on these hypersurfaces. And this, of course, is based on the old classical idea that everybody has clocks and rulers, which are classical clocks and rulers, and that defines the space-time. And it's interesting that such a truly classical idea still finds its way into quantum mechanics at the very foundations. And we might be interested in saying things like, well, actually, clocks and rulers are quantum systems. So what does that mean for the way we formulate quantum mechanics? We know from quantum metrology that you can't measure the metric to arbitrary precision. So we might start to question, you know, where does this causality actually come from? Where does space-time relations come from a quantum perspective? And there has been some recent work, for example, by Lucien Hardy and Czesław Bruckner's group, looking at reformulating quantum mechanics or just quantum mechanical thought experiments in which there's no definite causal ordering between local quantum mechanical laboratories. And we're going to take a slightly more extreme situation where causality is definitely violated. So in general relativity, of course, you don't have to have a globally hyperbolic space-time. You can have space-times which violate causality that are consistent with classical general relativity. These are space-times like this one containing a closed time-like curve. So there we have a fancy picture from Scientific American where the loop represents a closed time-like curve which you can then enter, interact with your past self, kill your grandfather, and create all sorts of problems for working physicists. And it's generally thought that a theory of quantum gravity is needed to resolve these paradoxes, either by providing a physical law which explains why closed time-like curves can never exist, or else by explaining how the paradoxes can be resolved in a self-consistent way. And it's currently an open question as to which of these two is in fact the case. But that's another reason why looking at toy models of these situations might give insights to quantum gravity. So let's try to formulate this in more precise terms. Here's a thought experiment involving a local laboratory, which I've got there at the bottom. The boxes represent just general CP maps, so coupling to some ancilla state and then tracing out. I'm assuming that we start in the vacuum state there, but I guess we don't have to. And then we're going to take At some point, we're going to take one of our lucky quantum states and send him out into the big universe where he may encounter causality violation, perhaps by going on a closed time-like curve, or it could be that fluctuations near the Planck level or something permit, you know, miniature causality violation, whatever the case may be. He then comes back into our laboratory, and we continue to do experiments. Now, we assume that the laws of physics within the laboratory are well described by ordinary quantum mechanics, that there is a sense of causality within our laboratory. And we just want to try to incorporate this one small element of causality violation into a consistent formalism. Now, that's not our research. This has all been done. I'm going to talk about one approach in particular. And the first thing that we need to do is try to abstract away the unnecessary details of what it is that's causing this causality violation. We just want to say, what do we mean when we say causality is violated for this quantum system? And there is more than one way to do this. There are at least two ways that we know of. I'm just going to focus on an approach proposed by Deutsch. And it's a much longer discussion as to why we might choose one approach over another. But this, I'll just say for now, has properties which I think are pleasing and make it an interesting one to look at. And the way that we do it is we say that a quantum state goes along, and at some point along its trajectory, it's allowed to jump into the past. So just reminding you about a quantum circuit diagram, there's implicitly this causal ordering in any quantum circuit where time runs from left to right in this diagram, and each unitary happens at a particular time before or after other unitaries, and we can say one happened before another. So now we're saying something crazy is happening because we're allowing this state to jump backwards in time and then continue on as normal. And specifically, in the formalism, the way that we would treat this using the Deutsch model is these two different rails that I've drawn there for the single system are just normal rails in the usual representation. Ah, thanks. Okay, these two rails represent different Hilbert spaces as normal. And this here is the reduced density matrix of this state here, keeping in mind that it may be entangled with other systems. And this is another reduced density matrix over here representing this system. And for us to say that this is the same system, we impose a constraint, which is that this reduced density matrix must be the same as this one. And that is Deutsch's requirement. Now, of course, because we have this guy jumping back in time, he could potentially interact with himself, for example, by trying to kill his own grandfather, or in quantum mechanical terms, he could stick a C-naught gate in there, which makes the input the opposite of whatever the output was found to be, and that would cause no end of havoc, or so you would think. The cool thing about the Deutsch model is that this is all described by just imposing this constraint. So we have some density matrix here and here, which we require to be the same. And we're given some input and some choice of unitary. And what Deutsch showed is that for any input density matrix and any unitary, there is always a self-consistent solution for what the output is over there. That is a self-consistent solution for the choice of rho. And we can therefore interpret that as being a completely consistent description of time travel or causality violation. It is nonlinear, which you can see by the fact that the solution for this rho must depend on rho itself in the equation. So that's explicitly shown here. This is the consistency equation. This rho has to be itself interacted with the input and then traced out again. So you solve this, you get your solution, and you calculate the output. And this nonlinearity has very non-trivial consequences. They are not paradoxical as such, but they are very strange. In particular, you can perfectly discriminate non-orthogonal states. I give you a pure state, I don't tell you what it is, you have no idea, it's some density matrix to you, and you can put it through a machine that's based on the CTC and you can tell which state I gave you. You can clone unknown states, and you can efficiently solve NP-complete problems in polynomial time. And these were all demonstrated using particular choices for some unitary here in the CTC. So we can sort of think about this as, well, you know, here's our time-traveling qubit interacting with its past self and doing all kinds of crazy transactions, and no wonder all these black things are happening. And our result is that actually, if you take that away, you get these. You can still perfectly discriminate non-orthogonal states, and you can still clone perfectly clone states, and there is evidence to think that you can still have computational speed up, but we haven't shown that, so I don't want to say too much about that. But this is really interesting. And the reason that we're the first to notice this is that we looked at continuous variables instead of qubits and discrete variables, which is what the previous work has done. So in particular, what we do is we just use quantum optics in our circuit and look at just linear quantum optics, coherent states, squeeze states, and so on. So that's basically our main result. The rest is just to talk about what that means. You know, why is it significant that there's no interaction in here? And that will turn out to be an interesting question. This is very spooky. And a couple of technical details on what the actual circuit is that allows you to do these things that I've claimed. So what we're going to do is we're going to do our non-orthogonal state discrimination and cloning on coherent states. So this is what a coherent state looks like in quadrature space. This is the X and P quadrature, and this represents the noise of the state displaced by complex number alpha. This here is a state which is squeezed in the X quadrature, so it has reduced noise on the X, but because of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, it must have increased noise on the other quadrature. And these are going to be our input states. We put them on a beam splitter, which entangles them. And then one of them, so I've written this as OTC for open time-like curve. It's just the CTC without an interaction using Deutsch's model. We stick that on one of the arms. Then we recombine them on a beam splitter. We don't care what happens to that one, and we look at this output. And what we find is that our coherent state has been squeezed a little bit along the same quadrature that our initial squeeze state was prepared in. And of course, the noise blows up in the other direction. But the important thing is that we haven't changed the displacement. And this is just a, you know, one-shot evolution. And you can't do that using normal quantum optics. It's illegal. And to see why it's illegal, we will now take it to its logical conclusion and violate Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So just to simplify that circuit a bit, I'm just going to call that whole thing with the two beam splitters and the time-like curve this box C. And we've got our coherent state in with some squeeze state resource that we prepared. And the output is that we've managed to squeeze it along that chosen quadrature. So let's say that we have repeated access to this causality violating system, or maybe we have many of them. So then what we can do is we get a whole bunch of states which are squeezed in the X quadrature and a whole bunch of states squeezed in the P quadrature. And we take our coherent state, split it up into two smaller ones. This will add noise to each of the produced coherent states. But it doesn't matter because we'll bulldoze through that noise with the nonlinearity. And then we just repetitively cycle it through that same circuit that I showed you before. Now, I didn't mention this, but originally, so the amount of squeezing you can get here, if your initial state is arbitrarily large squeezed in the X quadrature, the best you can do is to halve the amount of noise in the X quadrature on that output. But what we're doing here by repeating it the exercise many times is we're just squeezing it by an arbitrary amount along the desired quadrature. So these are the outputs that you get. One is squeezed really tightly along x and the other really tightly in the p quadrature without changing the displacement. And then, of course, we can just measure in those two quadratures and get a readout of what the amplitude of the coherence state is. And this is all just a single shot experiment. You just put in your states, they evolve through this thing, you do two measurements, and Bob's your uncle. You know what this unknown state was. So once you have that information, you can clone it as many times as you want, distinguish non-orthogonal coherent states. And since these coherent states are an overcomplete basis, you know, this is a pretty powerful thing. So the conclusion that we draw from this, and I should mention that these calculations are very straightforward to do. You just do exactly the Deutsch prescription for matching the density matrices. So our conclusion is that you can violate Heisenberg's uncertainty principle even when there's no interaction. But what does this mean? Why is this intuitively so spooky? Well, what actually causes the nonlinearity? So the interesting thing about an open time-like curve is that there is no grandfather paradox. Sure, we're allowing for the possibility quantum mechanically that there could have been one, but you know, in fact, there wasn't one. He could have killed his grandfather, but he decided not to. And in quantum mechanics, of course, it's less about what actually did happen and more about what could have happened that makes a difference to the physics. And it's interesting to note that actually the only classical effect is that this path is longer than the other path. So for example, if we were to measure the path length using some invariant parameterization, for example, something like the proper time, which I've illustrated using clocks, if our clocks are initially synchronized, ignoring the effects of special relativity and just looking at the general relativistic effects, we can reproduce the same effect just using time dilation. Because all that's happening is we're finding our initially synchronized clocks, they go off, they do something, we don't know what, and when they come back, there's a time difference on them. We don't have to ascribe that to causality violation because there's no grandfather paradox. We could ascribe that just to some much nicer curvature, like the curvature of Earth, for example. You know, maybe this clock was just further away from the Earth, so it ticked a bit faster. So what this means is that if you believe the Deutsch model is the correct description in the case of causality violating physics and space-time, for which we don't currently have a complete theory, then it follows from the Deutsch model that there will be observable nonlinear effects in the presence of any curvature. That's the conclusion that we draw. So what we want to do is try to get concrete predictions for what deviations we will see. And we don't need to do too much to do that, we just need to show. So the problem with the model is we haven't quantified the size of this time difference in terms of physical parameters and so on. It doesn't matter if this is really big or really small, this model will tell you the same thing. So we want to stick in a bit more physics to show that you can obtain normal quantum mechanics and appropriate limit. And I won't go into the details of this, but basically, this is the circuit that does the job. The input-output relations, in the case where this beam splitter is a swap gate, so if you choose it to transmit, then that completely reproduces the Deutsch model. But in general, this will only partially introduce nonlinearity. And in the case where this thing decouples these two parts of the circuit, you will obtain linear quantum mechanics, as though the open time-like curve wasn't there at all, for example. So using this generalized circuit, we can smoothly go between the nonlinear limit and linear quantum mechanics. And the parameter that tunes the amount of coupling to the nonlinear physics is this eta, which we take to depend on the coherence times of the detectors. So how well are they able to resolve this time difference introduced by the metric? And that turns out to be consistent with previous work and also generalizes it and makes it clearer. So in conclusion, contrary to what you might expect in a talk about closed time-like curves, there are potentially experimentally observable consequences if you take the way of modeling these crazy systems seriously. And so there's a paper up in the archive now which you can look at for more details if you're interested. Thank you.